Well, we've been talking about the honor of being a Christian and the responsibility that being a Christian entails. We pointed out that as Christians, God expects us to be growing. And we talked a little bit about two concepts, both of which are interrelated. The first is that we need to take stock of the church. And the second is that we need to take stock of ourselves. We need to examine ourselves to see how we're doing. Now, tonight we're going to talk about when we take stock of ourselves, when we examine ourselves, when we examine the church, what do we find? Well, the elders have asked us on a number of occasions recently to complete surveys, and they do that so that they can learn about where we are and about how we're doing. So tonight, we'll report out at least some of what we learned from those surveys that we took. Oh, sorry. I guess you might say that in a sense, what we're doing is looking at whatever letter might be written by the apostle to the church here at Coburg Road. And that's as it should be in Revelation, the second and third chapters. The writer talks to different churches, seven churches that are in Asia, and describes their state. So let's just think for a minute about these seven letters. The first is to the church at Ephesus, and we're pretty much familiar with this letter. To the angel of the church at Ephesus, write the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks among the seven golden lampstands. So we're talking about what Jesus observes in the church in these letters. We're not talking about self-examination, but both lead to the same end. Jesus says, I know your works, your toil, your patient endurance, how you cannot bear with those who are evil, but have tested those who call themselves apostles and are not, and has found them to be false. I know you are enduring patiently and bearing up for my name's sake, and you've not grown weary. And at this point, I'm feeling pretty good about myself if I'm a part of the church at Ephesus, right? This is for the most part, laudatory. But then he says, I have this against you, that you abandoned the love you had at first. Remember, therefore, from where you have fallen, repent, do the works you did at first. If not, I'll come to you and remove your lampstand from its place unless you repent. Well, this morning, Ted talked about how we, with our financial resources, make it possible for the church to continue. And it's possible because the church never raises funds other than through the free will contribution of those people that are members of the church. It's possible that the church would not have the financial capability to continue. And we would lose the building, we'd lose whatever we can muster to try to reach out to this community where we live. And it's possible that financially we could bring the church to an end. It's also possible that if the church is not what God wants, that God will bring it to an end. So Jesus says, you've lost your first love, you need to repent, and if you don't, I'll come to you and remove your lampstand from its place unless you repent. Yet this you have, you hate the words of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. He that has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I'll grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. Now we could make the same observation about each of these letters. Smyrna, the conclusion that you would draw reading about the church in Smyrna is that they were fearing those who seemed to persecute them. But for the most part, he is commendatory of the church in Smyrna. I would feel good if I was worshiping in Smyrna and this was God's examination of me. Pergamum, not so good. In the second chapter, verses 12 through 17, the emphasis is on surrendering the gospel, compromising with those people that were around them. Galatians, first chapter, verse 6 through 10, reminds us that you can't do that. If any man teach any other gospel than what I've delivered unto you, let him be accursed. It cannot be that the church compromises the gospel. Thyatira, they had given in to a domineering person. One individual was so toxic that they were destroying the church. Sardis, well, they thought they were alive, but God says, in reality, you're just dead. That's probably the worst of the letters that we read. Philadelphia, chapter 3, verse 7 through 13. Again, if I worshiped in Philadelphia, I'd feel pretty good about the church in Philadelphia. They were struggling to hold on to faithfulness, but the evidence is, at least from what I can read in this letter, that they were at least holding their own in this battle. Maybe they needed to hold on to faithfulness with an ever-tightening grip, but they were doing what they should have been doing. And then there's Laodicea, lukewarm. They were working, but their work was lukewarm. So now, having established the notion that God observes us, we observe ourselves, and we would write a letter like this to ourselves based on our own examination. The question is, how are we going to respond? There are a lot of different kinds of responses that are described for us. In the sixth chapter of Acts, verse 8 beginning, and all the way down through the beginning of the eighth chapter, you read about Stephen. Stephen examined those Jews that were there in Jerusalem. This is early on in the beginning of the church. And he basically calls them a stiff-necked and uncircumcised people. And their reaction to Stephen was that they gnashed on him with their teeth. That's the way it describes it in Acts 7 at verse 54. And we know ultimately that behavior issued in stoning Stephen to death. That's a response that is understandable. He had been censorious of them, and it made them mad. There's Saul in the ninth chapter, and we're familiar with his conversion story. He's on the road to Damascus to put the Christians in prison, or at least to bring them bound back to Jerusalem so that they can be imprisoned and perhaps even killed. He encounters Jesus on the road to Damascus, and Jesus says, Saul, why are you persecuting me? There's the indictment. There's the letter that Paul received from Jesus himself. And of course, Saul is shocked by that. He thinks he's been doing what he's supposed to be doing all along, and he hasn't been. and Jesus confronts him with that fact, then in verse 17, he goes on to Damascus. He's waiting for a man named Ananias who's going to come and tell him what he should do. And this is what it says. Ananias left after he had told Paul or Saul what he should do. He entered into the house, laid his hands on him. He said, "Brother Saul, the Lord, even Jesus, who appeared to thee in the way whence thou camest, hath sent me that thou mayest receive thy sight, be filled with the Holy Spirit." Straightway there fell from his eyes out and were scales. He received his sight and he was baptized. He took food and was strengthened. He was certain days with the disciples that were in Damascus. And straightway in the synagogues, he proclaimed Jesus, the one that had been persecuted, 180 degrees. You might even say that he began to declare Jesus with the same vehemence with which he had persecuted him. And Saul makes a statement a little bit later in his defense before the Roman authorities. He says, "I have lived in all good conscience toward God until this day." The apostle Paul, when he was Saul, lived in good conscience. He did what he thought he was supposed to be doing. He's misguided. And he had to respond, and he did. And he responded in a marvelous way. James describes a terrible way to respond to just ignore what we find. James says it's like a man who sees his face in a mirror, and then he walks away. And he forgets what manner of man he was. Surveying like this discovers some things about us, but it's important that we listen to what we learn. And if we don't do that, then there's no value in what we've been doing with surveys. So the question then becomes, what kind of a letter would Jesus write to us here at Coburg Road? What kind of letter would we write to ourselves at Coburg Road? And so this is kind of a synthesis of all the information that the elders received in the surveys. And it's something that we need to be aware of. In the first place, the letter would probably say to us, you're divided. You're not of one heart. You fall into groups. And I partly believe that. We fall into groups. I have a tendency to go to lunch after worship on Sunday morning with the same people every week. So does everybody else, or so do most people. We tend to separate into sometimes family units, sometimes groups that have something in common. And then there are the few who are kind of gadflies. They don't belong to any group. They're not a part of a family unit. They're not a part of some kind of an affinity for a certain practice. And those folks feel like they're on the outside. And they are. And that's our fault. We purposely exclude them. Our purpose is not to exclude them. We just don't include them. And so we're divided. Now, how are you going to deal with that? Yes, we're divided. What do we do to respond? Comments, questions. How would we respond to that? If that was the letter that we got from God, you're divided. What would we do? Start extending ourselves. How do we do that? How do we make that? How does that look if we do that?
Say, challenge.
Okay. Yeah, Ted.
I've got a quote
Dean Anderson, we just have to get out of our comfort zones. It's so easy to be with the people that you're always with. But we need to face change looking forward to it.
Okay.
We need to be not afraid to engage people that we don't really know.
Okay. It is a matter of engagement. And any other comments? Yeah, Kim.
Met with one another in their homes, home to home. And most people in this church, I think, have been to our home, but I've not been to most people's homes. And we need to be opening our homes. That's how we get to know one another. That's how you develop intimacy with one another, is you get to know each other on a very personal level by being in each other's homes. And I think that's something that this church maybe used to do pretty well, but I don't see that we've been doing that. And it could be that the pandemic affected that. And we moved here right as the pandemic hit. So my perception might be that we don't do that very well. And I think that that's something that this church needs to do more of.
Okay.
And that will go a long ways for us getting to include one another and know one another better.
Okay. Yeah. Carol?
Steve Burkhart was he was an elder. And when he had people over, he always tried not only with new people to make sure that they were invited to his house, or their house, but he also tried to think, well, now who might they like to be with? So he was always trying to pair somebody up with somebody so that they, not matchmaking, but pairing people up so that they could get together in groups.
Okay. That's a good point. Yeah. John?
I think we probably have to have a will to participate in things that we know about as well.
That's true. If you're an outsider, you need to try to be a part. So that's true. But I think it's incumbent upon us to say, I don't want to let this church become divisive or divided. Yeah. Susie.
Yeah, the broad, we have to prepare a nice deal or something to have somebody over. And that's not necessary. That's fine if you want to do it and if you're capable of doing that. But you can just invite somebody over to visit for the evening.
Sure.
A cup of coffee or a glass of ice water or whatever.
Sure.
I remember going to worship this guy a few years ago when Ralph and I were first married. We didn't have much money. Never had, but we did especially. And sometimes after church, we decide, oh, let's go make pizza at somebody's house. Somebody say, well, I've got the hamburger, and somebody else would say, well, I've got this, or I've got cheese. And it wasn't a hardship on anybody.
Yeah, when Kim and I lived in Alaska, we used to call that getting together for burnt offerings and sacrifices. Yeah, Carol.
I think one of the things is with this congregation is, unfortunately, we've gotten older, and so we don't really, a lot of us cook as much as we used to, and so we go out more, and that sort of runs the circle. If you're going out and get too big a group, it takes forever for somebody to sit down, and you know, and
yeah,
one person could go one place and another. So the fact that we don't do it, but Marcia's folks used to invite people over for soup and a sandwich.
Yep. So let me kind of segue from this to the next observation that's been made about this, is that many of us have become lazy. And I kind of hear that when we say, well, C. Burkhart and his wife used to do this, and the Nevilles used to do this, and so-and-so used to do this. It's time for us to step up and quit worrying about what so-and-so do and do it. Because, and the reason that we don't is we're lazy. And that's what it amounts to. It applies to our physical needs, okay? And, you know, I wouldn't tolerate my house being all torn up for 6 months the way we've tolerated this place being torn up for 6 months trying to get our classes organized. So we need to get about the business of doing the business. We tend to be a little bit lazy. Spiritually, we're lazy. We don't take the time to talk to people about the gospel. We take the lazy man's out and say, I'm living my life so that they will see my life and they will think, yes, this person's a Christian. I've never heard that observed about anybody just on the basis of what you can see. I've heard that statement made about a lot of people, but it's usually because those people, they're not in your face telling you about Christianity, but they talk about God. And we don't talk about God. Now, it could be that we have a tendency to talk about God and nobody else knows that we're talking about God. And that's kind of the way it should be. But I think we're a little bit lazy. We don't go out of our way to ask people about Jesus. And we're going to try to do something about that. Kim is very good about knowing how to engage people and to get them interested in the gospel. And so in a short while, we're going to have everybody that can come over to our house. And Kim's going to describe the way that she does this. It's called the Discovery Bible Study. And, you know, might be something that you can use. And if you have a way that you've been successful in talking to people, then we'll have you describe that as well. But we don't want to be lazy. We're not going to be satisfied with just going about our business. We're going to have to be more intentional about what we do. Yeah, Bill, you had your hand up, and I'm sorry. I didn't mean to ignore you.
Thinking, it seems to be the last 3 years, we become so dependent on Zoom that whenever the elders meet, Zoom cannot be eliminated from the church in our lives. And I think it's an excuse for a lot of people not to meet together anymore. Because it's always there. How did we ever survive without it? Why can't we go back to then?
Well, we could also go back to not having telephones. If you want to. That's a little farther back, but, you know, I think there is, you're right, but I think the same arguments were made about telephones. When we got telephones, people stopped going to their neighbor to see how they were doing. They called them on the phone. And I can remember my grandparents just distressed at no end that it seemed like we were dependent upon that blasted telephone. We ought to get rid of it. Instead, I think we need to learn how to use it. And you are right. Zoom can... And other methods of contact, whether it's message sending back and forth, direct messaging, IM, email, all kinds of things. They can be a crutch that we rely on that prevent us from, like Kim said, enjoying real personal contact. but we just have to learn to use it. It's a struggle for us to learn how to use it. But I, for one, don't want to go back to not having telephones. We could, but I don't want to do that. And I guess I'm one of the voices that is pleading with us to learn how to use electronic ways of contacting people, being in connection. It's not easy. Yeah, Ted.
One word I'd add to that is use it properly. There's a proper way to use it, and there's a way to use it. There are reasons that we have this technology available for those who can't be, who are physically not here, or who cannot be physically here because of illness, because of sickness. There's a great reason for this resource.
Yep.
And people will abuse it if it's not used properly.
Yeah, and we went we took a great deal of effort to make sure that this did not become a sermon on the couch where you just watch worship. We do a lot to make sure that you can participate in worship when you're using this tool. And people frustrate that because they join and listen. They don't participate. Okay, we even have the wonderful ability to turn that monitor off, to turn the video off, and we can even turn off the sound. Okay, so don't frustrate our ability. Let's learn how to use it. Yeah, Vicki.
Not knowing if I should say, is Zoom. I have told anybody that talks to me that Zoom means a very lazy Christian. Very lazy. What I prefer to stay home, and my PJs over sent out blue. Coming back here, I had to force myself to do it. So I chose not to sleep in on Sunday mornings, but to get my butt here to church like I should be. And one of the best things that has happened to me over the past few weeks is doing that Zoom thing with you in the morning. I would come in at the last minute of service, so I didn't have to talk to anybody. I'd come in at 9:29, find my seat, stay on my own. Coming in a half hour early, I get to visit with people who I haven't visited with for years. Get here early, get here on time, and visit with people. It has helped me so much. And so I am choosing to help you do your little Zoom thing on Sunday morning, so I have to be here a half hour early, but
and I
help me just a little thing to visit with people.
Right. Right. And take advantage. We start Zoom 30 minutes early because we want to give people lobby time to just visit back and forth. It does. You're only hurting yourself if you sign into Zoom and mute the microphone and mute and stop the video feed and go about your business until it's time to start, and then you walk up and pay attention to Zoom. Okay? You're right. But Zoom does not necessarily make us lazy. That's our choice. Yeah, Kim.
I was gonna say, same thing applies physically. Walk in at the last minute. It certainly does not give a good impression to the other people who are here. It's, you walk in at the last minute, you can't visit with people, you're rushed, and especially people who are taking a role in the public assembly. So you've kind of gotten lazy with that, and we're late, and we walk in late. And yeah, and you know, we had that problem at the Canyon Church, and we say, well, we start on Canyon time. And the elders put a stop to that. They said, no more Canyon time. We're going to start on time. Everybody needs to be here early.
Right.
So they just call it Canyon time. We start whenever. Whenever everybody starts.
Right.
So,
then that's a matter of laziness.
It demonstrates laziness, or demonstrates that you're making an effort, that it's important to you.
Okay. What else can we say? Yeah, Carol.
If the lazy sort of kicks,
maybe it's to say we're not as energetic as we should, not as engaged as we should be. And look at it from the positive side about what we need to do.
Okay, that's a possibility. But sometimes we need to just face the facts. And the facts are not always in our favor. Okay. I realize we want to make it as positive as we can. And I, you know, I have had a lot of conversations with John who tries to motivate sales teams. You know, what can we do to get the sales team doing what it should be doing? And one of the things that he has mentioned is we always talk about what we're trying to do, not berating people for what they're not doing. And I think there's a lot of value to that. Yeah, Dan.
We started with the letters to the churches. Most of those letters start with the positive, what you're doing right, and then conclude what you're doing wrong.
Right.
We can talk about the things we're doing right, too. We can do that, and we can commend ourselves for certain things. But those aren't the things we need to work on.
Right.
Things that we're not doing right.
Right.
Things that we need guidance to repair, to fix, to do better. And so those things are what we have on the board.
Okay. Last thing that I think our letter would say is, a lot of you are spiritually babies in terms of your understanding of biblical information. You're still operating on the basis of, do you remember when you were in junior high school, even before that, fifth, sixth grade, and you would go to Bible class and you had these books and it was a sentence with the last word eliminated and you had to fill in that last word? And it was just like what was read. It was just, it was exactly like what the text said. That's where a lot of people are staying. Got to grow beyond that. If that's what your idea of Bible study is, you're in trouble. You will be destroyed when you deal with Satan and his people. We are not where we should be in terms of biblical knowledge. We don't know how to reason about the Bible. And that's dangerous. We're pretty good at repeating the things that we've been told. But we're not very good at reasoning ourselves. And if that's where we're going to stay, we will be destroyed. We cannot be babies. And I have, on more than one occasion, people have said, I'm immature. And they've been Christians for 30 years. That could be one of three problems. Could be that you've got bad teaching. Could be that you're a really bad student, and it could be a combination of the two. But let's not let it be that we're a bad student. So the question is, what are we going to do about it? Are we going to grow, be committed to growing? Be committed to being made to feel uncomfortable? Or are we just going to stay where we are and slowly die, cherishing the memories of the great Christians who used to worship here? It's up to us. Yeah, Kim.
I'm glad we're having this conversation. I think this is good. I think sometimes we need to have the harsh conversations, and this is a harsh conversation. But I think we're doing this with a very limited number of people. I think this information needs to be presented to a much greater group of people. And my recommendation would be to take this information, other information that was gathered with the surveys, and work them into some lessons to be presented on Sunday morning when more people are here. Because we all need to hear this, not just this small group of people. We all need to hear what we said about ourselves, how we've evaluated ourselves. And I think it can be done in a way that's loving in sermons and delivered that way. And maybe with input, if you're delivering the sermon, with input from the elders, so that it's coming from the elders and you're the spokesperson, and that's a fine position for an evangelist to be in. But I think that's where this information needs to be disseminated further than this group. This is a good start, I think. But I think we all need to hear these hard lessons.
Okay.
They're hard to hear.
And it's up to us individually to do something about it, you know. Oh, Dean.
I know. I usually don't step in. I agree 100% with Ken. That this is, and our new format right now, our new format is an excellent format to do this, because we haven't figured out how to circumvent the system yet, which is coming. I just think, I struggle. I agree with John in the fact that we need to present positive. But I also think that as a society, we have gotten so soft. And it started clear back when we gave everybody participation awards and nobody was player of the week. And we are pathetic. We can't accept criticism. And I can't imagine how most of us would do. And I'm sitting back here biting my tongue as I'm hearing comments. We don't self-examine enough. And I could use examples, but I don't want to offend anybody specifically. But we make a comment about what the church should do, and yet we're only doing a fraction of it.
Well, it's true.
So it's that I'm pointing a finger, but all the rest of them are pointing back at me. You know, and Ted's comment was excellent. The books start with greetings, salutations. I thank God for the work that you're doing. But, there's a but. You are not doing this, and you are not doing this, and you are not doing this. And those things point at me, and I honestly, I thrive better in those environments. I know what I do right. I don't need you to tell me. I don't need you to pat me on the back. I'm okay with you pointing out the shortcuts.
Okay.
Because I know that you care about. I know that Kim cares about. So Kim comes and says, hey, you know, whatever it is, I have this relationship with Kim that allows us to have that conversation. We have to quit being so soft, number one. Number two, we have to quit worrying about those who are soft. We have to do what is right. We have to accept the fact that we as a congregation are suffering from heart disease. You have it. That's one of the first symptoms. You get lethargic. Why? Because your blood isn't pumping, so you're tired and you're lazy. And that's the beginning. That's the beginning of this catastrophic event that lands you in the ER with a splitting your chest open and hoping that you survive. Those are analogies that I think that we can use, and I think that they're effective. But we have to quit just patting people on the back and tell them how great they are when they're not. And that applies to me. That applies to you. That applies to everybody in this room.
Okay.
And so, go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, I agree with all of that, but the only way to achieve that is to have a relationship. You can't be honest and authentic and transparent, and to really be able to examine your own deficiencies and where you need to grow and to help someone else do the same, unless you have relationship. And I do think that we are suffering from the effects of the pandemic and us being separated for so long. I think at by and large, the elders handled all of that as well as they could. But I do think that we are suffering as a result of that. We have distanced ourselves. We got out of the habit of having relationship and being with each other and getting to know one another so that we can have those candid conversations. Yeah, I feel like I can go to Dean and I can talk with him about something and he can come to me. But because we have that trust relationship. But maybe we don't have that with other people because we haven't developed it, and we have to develop that. I think that you started by being divided. I think that's a good starting point. And if that's what came out of those surveys, I think that's good. And then we need to go from there. We aren't where we need to be physically or spiritually. You know, and I hesitate to say, I don't know a good way to say this, and I'm going to put it out there because I've said it before, and I think I've said it in frustration to Dean, that of all the congregations we have ever worshipped at, the biblical knowledge at this congregation is severely lacking. Severely. And I don't know why.
I can tell you why.
I don't.
I can tell you why. And this might have been people might not. We hired a preacher, and for 7 years, the man stood in the pulpit and did not want to hear what we had to say. Stood in the pulpit and said, the elders hired me to teach you, not you to teach me. And we fell into this lectureship style Bible class where there was absolutely no interaction. When this congregation brought, we had preachers like Dan Mick, who would teach a class, and in that class, you had questions. He had quizzes. You got called on. You had to answer. We were forced. When you have a teacher that stands in front of the class and just talks, nobody's tested. Period. Nobody's tested. And if we're never tested, so can you imagine as a professor teaching a college course and never testing your kids? They'll all get A's in your book, but they won't have an ounce of knowledge to present the world on the outside. So having classes where we have open discussion, having classes where we call on somebody and ask them questions, putting out lesson sheets. I mean, I appreciate many putting out lesson sheets. We have to stop having generic Bible classes. Okay, yes, our knowledge is low, but just having Bible overviews gets nobody anywhere. It just doesn't. We can study it. We can talk about it. This congregation, knowledge-wise, has been struggling for years. We've created this situation. So we're going to have these classrooms back here. Let's break it up into smaller classes.
Okay.
You know, let's get those things done. But we also have to call people on the carpet and say, wow, we're just not that close. Why aren't we close? Look at this side of the building right here. Look at it. Why aren't we close? How am I going to have a relationship with people that are not here?
Okay.
You know, it's time to just get real, in my opinion.
Okay. Now, let it also be said, this is not where you build relationships in this building.
Correct. However, this is where we start as a group.
Okay, I agree.
This is where we start as a group.
I agree, but we're going to have to learn that we do not build relationships like Kim was talking about in this building. If you're not doing it outside of this building, it's not going to work. So if you want to have relationships, go outside this building. Now, being in the building is important, I think, you know, several people talk about Zoom and how Zoom can be, can hamper that. But this is not where you build relationships. You're going to have to do it outside. So, okay. Well, it's this is good beginning.
Dean?
Yeah, somebody has something to tell me.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that in our relationships. But I think when we're talking about the growth of our church, instead of, well, we do need to add numbers. But I think we need to focus on why are we losing so many of our young families? Why is that happening? And that is hurting our church as much or more as not bringing in new people.
Well, that's true. That's true. Okay. This happens almost every week. We're out of time. So let's have a prayer, and we will continue. I think that was Margaret that was talking, wasn't it? Yeah. Okay. I some voices I can immediately recognize, and some I struggle with a little bit, but we'll continue this. This is not the only time that we'll have a discussion like this. And it's important. So let's do what we can. If there's something we can do to help you in your relationship with God, if you need to establish that relationship, we'll help you. If you need to return to that relationship, we'll, of course, work with you to do that. But we want you to think about it. We're going to stand in just a minute, and Ted's going to lead us in a song, Trust and Obey. It's an interesting concept, and it's a concept that you can think about in terms of what was going on with Paul in the 27th chapter of Acts. Trust and obey. You're going to have to stay in the ship, or you're going to be lost.